Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being with us today. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, or good afternoon, wherever you are. This hour, we'll be taking a lot of your calls. We're talking money, finances, shopping, and debt. Black Friday has come and gone. So has Small Business Saturday. Now we're midway through Cyber Monday. We're at a place and time when the days of the weeks are being marketed to prompt us to spend. But honestly, who has the cash on hand to do so? You may have seen this stat. According to a federal survey, 40% of adults can't cover a $400 emergency expense. They'd have to borrow or sell something to cover that cost. This was the case with a couple recently interviewed for a magazine called Wealth Simple, an in-house publication for an investment management firm. The piece is called Debt, a Love Story. It's an anonymous couple who use pseudonyms of Tom and Kate, and they shared their finance woes in the form of an interview. They're Americans who live in the suburbs, shop at Goodwill, can't pay off their staggering debt on credit cards and student loans. They live paycheck to paycheck, yet they send their kids to private school, and they shop at Whole Foods. This has hit really close to home for some and made others cringe. This story has gone viral. So today we have with us to discuss the piece, Debt, a Love Story, Andrew Goldman, contributing editor at Wall Street Journal Magazine and host of The Originals, a new interview podcast. He wrote this piece about Tom and Kate. And we also want to get you to join this conversation on debt and spending. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. What are your thoughts on debt and culture? Do you have any financial horror stories you need to share? You can be anonymous too, that's okay. And once you hear about Tom and Kate, we want to know your thoughts as well. So Andrew, can you give us a brief rundown on this couple, Tom and Kate, who they are? Are they college educated? Are they white? Where do they live? Suburbs, the whole thing.
Yeah, Tom and Kate are a suburban couple. They are white. They live, I think I can divulge, they live in a suburb in the northeast of this country. They are both college educated, and they both have advanced degrees. One has a graduate degree in advertising. The other one actually went to law school. Wow. And they're successful people, I think, by pretty much any measure. Kate, who's 46, works for an insurance company, and she makes $70,000 a year. And her husband, Tom, works in advertising, and he's 48, and he makes 90. So they have a household income of about $160,000. And I think that if you saw them at a Whole Foods, if you saw them anywhere, they would look like pretty much any upper middle class white American family. I mean, the thing that I think that I've realized from doing this piece is that people don't carry around how much credit they're carrying on their foreheads. This is not something that they advertise.
Right.
And, you know, we allowed them to be anonymous, and they were incredibly candid about their credit troubles, which I'm sure you'll want to talk about.
Absolutely. So they have about $60,000 in unpaid credit cards, $18,000 in a personal loan, mortgages over $300,000. Does that sound
right? They have. They were given both a primary mortgage as well as a home interest line of credit on this new home. They were in a three-bedroom home, I'm sorry, that they paid $195,000 for. And they found that it didn't have enough of a yard, and they wanted an extra room. So they were able to get basically a mortgage and a home interest line of credit for the entire purchase price of the home, which they used to do pre-mortgage meltdown. So it's a $360,000 house, and they have $360,000 in debt on it.
And then the student loans on top of it.
They don't even know how much the student loans are.
That was fascinating in the piece. At some point, you asked them, or the wife asked the husband, how much? And he said, I can't even look on it online anymore.
Yeah, well, I think that I think it's partly because who can remember passwords on sites? But he doesn't have a handle on what the student loans are because they put them in forbearance for decades. And this is something that I don't know if I even knew was possible, that you could say that hey, we're having some financial hardship now. We're just going to basically allow these loans to grow and the interest to grow, and we'll pay them someday, ideally. But they have kicked this can down the road for decades now. And so just the law school loan Kate estimates, I think it started at a $90,000 loan for law school, and I think she said it's ballooned to somewhere, and she doesn't know exactly, between $110,000 and $120,000.
Right. I'm going to do this. I'm going to read this Q&A. Kate says, "We almost never paid my law school loans. Every year we ask them to put us in a financial hardship status so we don't have to pay, but the interest keeps building." Then Tom says, "I think education loans probably start us on this path, but credit cards got us in trouble." Mm. How did they get in trouble with the credit cards?
Well, how does anybody get in trouble? You know, what's sort of interesting and ironic about this couple is that I think they are the standard couple. I don't want to say standard because I don't think this is a normal experience. But it seems like the more credit cards they max out, the more credit card companies come and ask them to basically take out more credit. I think that those people who pay only the service on their credit card debts are considered for credit card companies the ideal, because the debts just grow larger and larger, and the principals are larger, and they're just paying all debt service. And this is what credit card companies want. So, you know, this is a couple that had, you know, they have upwards of $800,000 of debt now. What's really interesting about it is that Tom liquidated his 401k about a decade ago, and they also had a family loan. They're not from well-to-do families either. They had a family loan of, I think, $40,000, mm-hmm. and they went into consumer credit counseling. And with that $40,000 loan about 10 years ago, they wiped out their $80,000 credit card debt. But 10 years later, they've gotten themselves to exactly the same place. So it's obvious they have some spending issues. I mean, I think you started off by saying that they shop at Goodwill. I think that that's something that Kate said, and her husband said, well, that's not really true, Kate. That's, you know, they do shop at Goodwill. I think that they make certain allowances, but they spend as though they're making twice, three times, four times what they're making.
I have a question for you, and I feel I have to ask this. How do we know Kate and Tom are real? Because when you read this story, you can't believe. It sounds like, I keep going back to this, the GoFundMe scammers.
Yes.
How do we know Kate and Tom are real?
I have two children. I will personally swear on the life of my two kids that Kate and Tom are real. Though I have not looked at their financial statements, I can tell you that they're real. I know I sound pretty sketchy right now, but I've worked in journalism for like 20 years.
No, I know what you're doing. You told them that they would remain anonymous.
They would remain anonymous, and I've actually had conversations with Kate. And
you're concerned about
that.
She's
a little freaked out because this thing has gone viral, and she feels like even though we changed certain identifying details, enough were in there so that if her members of her family read it, they would identify her. So short of me explaining exactly how I found Tom and Kate, it's going to be difficult for me. You're just going to have to take my word on it, but I swear— I've never been in any journalistic scandals before. That's not my thing. So these people are real. It was a harrowing 2-hour conversation. The tears were real. Kate, as she mentions in the piece, had to leave the house. The impression I got is that they are in such a state of denial that, you know, I think Kate wanted to do this because she thought it would be therapeutic. My impression is that she and Tom very rarely actually speak about this. It's the unspoken thing. The kids, they have three kids. The kids have no idea that their parents are in financial peril. And, you know, Kate, in the course of the conversation, began to cry. It's obviously, she said it's exacerbated her depression. You know, Tom, it really struck me, and I think about it a lot. Tom said that he can't get to sleep without having Adam Carolla podcast on, because otherwise his head would just spin into this place. I mean, you know, a lot of people on social media obviously despised Tom and Kate, which I found surprising, because it's obvious to me that though they may have maybe living a lifestyle beyond their means, they're in total misery, absolute misery. I mean, they said that you know, every time they go out for a meal, they can't enjoy themselves with their family, because ultimately what's going to happen is they're going to have to pull out their credit card. And it's just a reminder.
Yeah.
Every time a credit card comes out, it's a reminder that, as Tom said, that we have good life insurance and we're actually better off dead.
I was going to ask you, based on the mental state of these two folks, there is that moment when they both say, like, yeah, we have great, we're better off dead than we are now. Mm-hmm. Do you think either of them is seriously having mental health issues as a result of this?
How could you not? You know, speaking for myself, I lost a job a few years ago, and I know personally the kind of stress that one goes through if you have a family and you're trying to put a good face on, and it was nothing like they've experienced. Yeah, I have to imagine, God forbid, you know, Wealthsimple is a great company based in Toronto, and Wealthsimple has, and we've communicated to them that we'd like to try to help them. We have certified financial advisors that are going to work with them to try to somehow get themselves on a path to recovery. You know, because I was really sort of surprised that people on social media just loathed them so much, because I read it, and to me, it sort of reads like alcoholism.
I was going to say, it reads like addiction. When
yes.
you read the piece, it definitely reads like addiction. We're talking to Andrew Goldman about his piece, Debt, A Love Story. Let's take a quick call. This is Kelly from Freeport, New York. Hi, Kelly.
Hi there. I was just commenting. I missed some of the story, but I do identify with them in the way that I, you know, live in a comfortable middle-class existence, but I am sending my children to a school that is above my means, and it has become a priority, you know, because it's a whole lifestyle, and we've been involved in it for so long, and it's such a beautiful experience, but it's a struggle. And I know, I mean, we could be living in a better house, you know, and have vacations, and if we sent them to a public school, but it's just the private experience that they receive and the attention to detail is so incredible. But it's hard when you're doing something above your means, but it's something that you deeply value. And so every day, you know, you kind of have that pull, you know,
Kelly,
the struggle.
Yeah, Kelly, thank you so much for being so candid and sharing your story. We appreciate it. If you want to get on this conversation, the number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. So, Andrew, one of the things that I found interesting is that the husband, Tom, does not want to declare bankruptcy.
No, and you know, I looked into it after, because it seemed odd. The stated reason that he did not want to declare bankruptcy was that were he to apply for another job, he said one of the questions they ask is, have you declared bankruptcy? And, you know, I looked that up, and I did find that, you know, there's a law actually about holding bankruptcy against people in terms of hiring. But many employers, even for, you know, even if you're going to go work at a fast food restaurant, they will frequently check your credit history. And I don't know what they're intending to get from that, mm-hmm. but the fact that they could see that you've gone bankrupt, one would imagine this would sort of affect their perception of you. So he's very much afraid that, you know, he wants to keep this a secret very much. He doesn't want this to be something that is checkable through public records or credit searches.
They also made a, and it sounds like it's a joke, but I'm curious from your spidey sense as a reporter and a journalist, that they're too poor to even get divorced.
Oh, I think. Are you married?
I am.
You've never thought about this before? Like the economics of marriage and divorce? And I've never thought about divorcing my wife. But yeah, I mean, I think that anybody who's married understands that as a team, you know, you file joint income taxes and... And were one of us to leave, that would be another rent or another mortgage. And that's, you know, far beyond my means, certainly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that they have thought, she probably has thought that. I think that she said the only time that she's thought about, really seriously thought about divorcing Tom was when he refused to declare bankruptcy, which she felt like was the only way out of this mess.
It's interesting. There've been a couple of articles written about this piece as well. It's grown mm-hmm. tentacles. And one of them was in Slate, and the writer's position was, this is the name of the article, "The couple in that horrifying viral personal finance diary is a sad indictment of capitalism." And the writer seemed to feel that this couple, like many couples, find themselves in a place where corporations are finding endless ways to mess with you and to get you to spend more and to put you more and more in debt. So that's the one side. And then the other side of are the people online who are saying, what about personal responsibility? You mm-hmm. really don't have to send your kids to private school. You really don't have to shop at Whole Foods. Those are just choices you're making that you put you in this position.
There again, the issue of addiction. I mean, I think that they would probably, if there were enough groups, they would go in and say, I am a spending addict or, mm-hmm. or something. I think that they have a problem. And I think that, you know, I think that there are financial companies, the ones that are sending them the offers, that probably have very high interest rates, who know that there's a good chance that they're going to default. But they offer them anyway. You know, what's interesting is, you know, they do say that perhaps we'd be better off dead because of the life insurance. But when they do die, their heirs, their estate's going to inherit this debt. And if it keeps going the way it does, I imagine that the debt that their kids are going to inherit some of this debt.
Let's take a call. Can we take Linda on line 3? She's actually calling us from San Francisco. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. What do you want to add to the story?
Just that it must be putting such an incredible strain on their marriage. I went through a similar situation with my ex-husband, low these many years, and we both were very spendy, lived above our means, traveled above our means, and we were paying his college loans. And I really feel like that contributed to our breakup. You know, the financial strain was just too much. We were depressed, and I was angry at him for, you know, buying tickets to Bruce Springsteen instead of, you know, paying off our credit cards. I think that was the final straw. It makes me sad to think about it.
Linda, thank you so much for sharing your story. We appreciate it.
I think it's so much more common than we imagine. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said before, it's just nobody advertises their personal debt, but I believe that on every block, there's one or two of these cases. You know, I was looking at this number. The average household debt, the government reported, and this is including housing, is $137,000 nationally. And the median income is only $59,000. So I think that there are people, most people are probably living beyond their means.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's this one paragraph that Tom says, this one answer, I'm sorry, that Tom says. He says, I do all the bills. I don't know how I ended up with it, but I'm pretty good at it. It sounds so wrong coming out of my mouth, but I make it into a game. Like, oh, I'm going to get this money here so I can pay it there, and I know my mortgage has 30 days to pay. It's like a puzzle. And then Kate talks about her depression, and he says, I don't let it get it to me that way, but I was pretty upset about the 401k situation. Ugh. What was the 401k situation?
Well, the 401k situation was one of the attempts they made to basically eliminate their debt was to do something that most people, most financial advisors would tell you never to do, which is to liquidate a 401k before you're,
ouch,
I think, 59
yeah.
and a half. Because there are, you know, 401ks are designed, the government designed them to give people tax breaks for saving for retirement so that the government didn't have to take care of them. But they also inflict major tax penalties if you liquidate the money before that. So Tom took, I think, he liquidated his 401k, which was worth $70,000. So he was able to take $70,000 out and I think wiped out, I think he said, something like 8 credit cards. Only at the end of the year to realize that the tax burden was going to be $20,000, which they didn't have the money for. I don't think that you're able to pay the IRS with a credit card, but they did get another credit card to put the $2,000 that they owe to the state on. So there again, they're, you know, right back into the same cycle.
Let's talk to Hugh in Manhattan. Hugh is on line 1. Hi, Hugh. Hugh, are you there?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can.
All right, thanks. Yeah, so, you know, I was in a similar situation. I owned a home with my ex-wife, and we bought it right before the big recession around 2006 to 2008. So unfortunately, we locked it at a fairly high APR, and then we lost a lot of our means of income during the recession. And, you know, our mortgage went underwater. We used credit cards to make ends meet. And we kept going deeper and deeper into this debt hole until I finally realized the only option was bankruptcy. I mean, you know, I could have kept going into this vicious credit card cycle until I could have never gotten out of it and faced a lot of the circumstances that your guest is talking about regarding these other people. And, you know, yes, it was painful. You know, I had to do more with less. I had to declare bankruptcy. I couldn't keep running things on credit cards. I couldn't just take loans to solve problems. I had to use public institutions instead of going to private institutions. But quite frankly, it was the only option. And in the long run, I've had a much happier and fulfilling life since that experience because I practiced prudent spending habits and got myself out of that debt hole.
Hugh.
And, you know, one thing that is hard for me to personally understand is that I didn't come from good means, but I, at the same time, I wasn't poor when I went down this path. And, you know, it made me realize it doesn't matter how rich or poor you are. It's what you do with the money you have. And people, and especially people that work on a debt-based work in a debt-based economy, seem to be very irresponsible about their spending, not just on a personal level, but a social level. So when people say, oh, well, you know, I want to go to private schools because, you know, I appreciate the experience more, well, I consider that laziness, frankly, because even in school systems that are failing, there are good schools out there that you can bust your ass to get into. It takes a lot more work, takes a lot more focus, but people need to stop being lazy and think that they can spend their way out of things. They need to take responsibility for themselves and their community financially.
Hugh, well, congratulations on working your way out of that. Let's go to Gabriella and Rye on line 3. Hi, Gabriella.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I wanted to add, I, like Kate, have a law degree, and I used to work as an attorney, and when I was single doing that, I racked up about $15,000 worth of credit card debt. I met my husband, and he said, that's ridiculous, I'm paying it off right now, and we're not doing that anymore. And he was right, actually, and he got me into more of a minimalist sort of mindset, in that we only buy stuff that we are willing to babysit, you know, and that we, you know, we consider very carefully what we're buying. We're not really minimalists exactly, but the main expenditure that we spend very little on is housing, and that is we live in an area that's very wealthy, but because we live in a one-bedroom apartment instead of a house, and we have one child, our taxes are only $4,000 instead of about $25,000 a year. And basically doing that, we have a fantastic school district that's public. We don't pay for private housing. So by just that one decision, instead of buying, the houses around here are around $800,000. And so, you know, changing that part of the equation. You know, I can go out and just, you know, buy a bunch of stuff that I probably shouldn't have, and then, you know, but we pay everything down every single month. Mm-hmm. And it's mainly because of the housing. And we live around people who are very wealthy, appearing or living, and some of them have confessed to me, they're like, oh, goodness, we don't know how we're going to keep the house. So that one decision, and my husband had to convince me because I really thought I needed a three-bedroom, two-bath house minimum. But because of that, we go on these lavish vacations. We spend tons of money on figure skating on our daughter. You know, we have tons of money mainly because of that one decision.
You made a good choice there for your family. Gabriella, thank you so much. You know, Andrew, as we wrap this up, it's interesting the tone of the callers because a lot of folks it's about choice. Mm-hmm. People understand about what different people have different priorities, yeah. Which I find kind of interesting. From just objectively as a journalist, is there a place, the way that Gabriella said she made one really good decision, mm-hmm. is there just a bad decision that they made that really started all of this?
I wonder if there's one bad decision. I think it was probably a series of bad decisions. I mm-hmm. mean, we can't say that they shouldn't have gone to law school or grad school. I mean, I think one thing that I keep thinking about when I think about Tom and Kate is this notion of, I hadn't heard this term before. Have you heard of lifestyle creep?
Yeah, actually I have. Yeah.
Lifestyle creep is where things that once seemed to you to be luxuries all of a sudden become necessities in your life. And I feel like when we have Tom and Kate, who can barely cover the service on their credit cards, you know, they go to Whole Foods on the weekends and their kid wants to get the sushi and the smoothie and it costs them $15 or $20.
And they want to go to the prom, but they can't afford a tux, but they do have a credit card at Nordstrom's, so they
Yeah, they couldn't afford to come
buy
up
a
with
a suit.
They couldn't afford to come up with the money to rent a tuxedo, so they did know that they had the Nordstrom card, so they went to Nordstrom and they had to put, I mean, they had to put one of their dogs down and they didn't have the cash to do it, so they had to put that on a credit card. It's just, so if I had to say one thing, it's just the notion that as you get older, you feel like, and this, I think this American culture sort of promotes this idea that, you know, we should be comfortable. And I think this comfort comes at great expense. And I think that's what happened to Tom and Kate.
It's a fascinating read. We'll link to it on our site. Andrew Goldman, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your reporting and all of your work. And also, you can check out Andrew's podcast. It's called The Originals, and it's out now. We'll be right back with this week's classical music picks from our colleague and regular Monday contributor, Clemency Burton Hill. This is all of it on WNYC. Welcome back. I'm Allison Stewart, and you are listening to All of It. Now's the time in our Monday show where we get classical. Get it? With our colleague, Clemency Burton Hill. I'm working on it, Clemency. She's WNYC's creative director for music and arts and has a new book out called Year of Wonder, Classical Music to Enjoy Day by Day. It's a collection of compositions, one for each day of the year, with an accompanying anecdote or backstory for every piece. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're starting. I usually don't listen because I want to experience them, but then I saw the title of this piece and I was like, I have to Google it. Music for Pieces of Wood.
And guess what?
It is
Music for Pieces of Wood.
When I clicked on the video of YouTube, I was like, those are people standing there with pieces of wood in their hand.
And I love that. This is by Steve Reich, great American composer. He is, thank goodness, still with us, born in 1936, still writing away, still creating incredible music. And I love Steve Reich because contemporary classical musicians often get a pretty bad rap. If they're thought about at all, you might think of them as being very sort of, you know, intellectual and perhaps just operating on a sort of plane that us mere mortals can't possibly understand. He is a good example of an avant-garde composer who actively wants to connect with his audience. He once said, I write music and I want people to listen to it and care about it and have it make some difference in their lives. When I'm fortunate for that to happen, I feel very, very good about it. And personally speaking, Steve Reich has had a big impact on my life. I love how unpretentious he is. I love that this is music for pieces of wood. You have a kid, you remember the toddler toy box.
Of course.
When they were like, you know, this is the instruments that this piece is written for are the same bits of wood that you might find in a toddler soft play or a toy box or somewhere. And I love that it is music that does exactly what it says on the tin. And yet, if you unpick it, what he's doing is fantastically complex and it's very mathematical and it's dazzlingly clever and really has a mesmerizing effect. But you don't need to know any of that to just kind of get the overall effect. So let's have a little listen.
I love the syncopation on the upbeat.
Yeah, and on it
on
goes.
The end.
And you could kind of, you know, you might be thinking, yeah, I could do that. It's the kind of a Picasso equivalent mm-hmm. of classical music. My three-year-old could do that.
How was he trained?
I think he had very, very deep classical roots. Mm-hmm. So he's one of those people who has got absolutely his classical chops down, if you like, you know, comes from a tradition whereby you absolutely, you know, respectful mm-hmm. of the kind of classical things that we might think about when we initially think classical music, but became one of the founding fathers of American minimalism and, you know, has trained all over the world, has been very, very influential on all sorts of planes, not just the concert hall, but you know, you might hear his influence in film music, in video mm-hmm. game soundtracks, and you know, it's a good example of Steve Reich piece, but not everything just sounds like that he does. But I just love that for a very sort of refreshing take on what classical music can be.
Okay, that was November 26th. Today we're gonna pop over to the 28th of November. You are one of my favorites.
Oh,
you know this is one of my favorites.
I didn't know this is
one
of your favorites.
Oh, I thought, well, just a happy accident.
I had no idea. This is a nocturne by Frédéric Chopin. So now we're back in the real sort of core mm-hmm. classical sound world. Lyrically sumptuous, hyper-romantic on the surface. I love the fact that classical music composers are kind of in conversation and dialogue with each other across space and time. So the first classical nocturnes were written in the 18th century, actually by an Irish composer, called John Field. He was one of the first people who took this form. And yet composers throughout the eras and the ages have taken that and run with it and given their own stamp to it. And one of the things that I do in Year of Wonder in the book is cross-reference some of those things so that you can hear what a 21st century female composer is doing with a nocturne like Dobrynka Tabakova versus what Chopin does with it. But he is really the godfather of the nocturne, Chopin, because what he does just takes it onto a whole other level of beauty. He kind of alchemizes, if you like, what everyone else does with his singular musical genius. And although it's very romantic on the surface, as I say, there's definitely darkness lurking there. Robert Schumann memorably said, "Guns buried in flowers." And I always thought that was such an incredible description.
Wow.
So he wrote 21 nocturnes. This is one of my faves. I hope you enjoy it too.
That piece is composed for piano, right?
It is indeed.
Beautiful.
You could probably riff on it with other instruments too, but it kind of works so perfectly on the piano.
And now we're going to go to the last day of November, the 30th, yes, with someone who is a contemporary.
He is a contemporary. So another contemporary composer like Steve Reich, James Macmillan. He was born in 1959. He's a really towering presence in British musical life. So I chose this one for St Andrew's Day, celebrated in the UK. So James Macmillan, great, great Scottish composer. And he's a really interesting one. You know, he's very engaged with real life, which you can't say for all classical composers. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a sort of idea of these lofty creatures elevated and doing their thing on this ivory tower and on a different plane from what real human beings are actually having to live through and endure and go through. And James Macmillan is not that at all. He kind of gets his hands dirty with the stuff of real life. He's on Twitter, he's talking about politics, he's talking about religion. I mean, really no-go areas for a lot of musicians.
I have to say, when I saw this and I saw social media presence, I did a double take. When I said, wait, someone we're talking about today?
Yeah, go check him out. Go follow him on Twitter. He's absolutely brilliant, brilliant mind and very interesting on a number of topics. This is his setting of the Miserere, and there's a very famous setting of this by Allegri, written centuries before. And again, a little bit like the nocturne, I'm intrigued how contemporary composers and different voices will treat the same material. And that happens so much in classical music in a way that it often doesn't happen in pop music. You know, the same stuff gets rolled out and interpreted into completely different ways. So his setting is, I think, incredibly haunting. And I'm really intrigued by what I'm seeing as a kind of renaissance in sacred choral music. You know, I've been doing some research about it. Spotify, for example, there are 300,000 playlists that have sacred choral music in them. And the very same people that are driving a trend towards secularism in our society, if you look at the demographic, tend to be the same group of people who are streaming that music. So I'm intrigued
by that.
That's
interesting.
What does that say about our society, that we no longer really have the presence of God? I mean, obviously for many people they are, but for a lot of people who would identify not with any particular belief or would even identify as atheist or agnostic are nevertheless still finding this succor and this solace and this somehow there's some sort of spiritual gift that's being delivered by sacred choral music. So I'm intrigued by that phenomenon. And this is a wonderful example of contemporary sacred choral music. Let's have a listen.
So sweet.
Is that a tear in your eye,
Alison
Stewart?
It's so sweet.
Is it? It's very moving, I think, to just hear human voices.
Mm-hmm. It's lovely.
Singing together.
Clemmie, thanks as always.
Thank you so much.
You'll be back next week with more stories and selections from Year of Wonder. When we come back, we're talking about the beloved mom and pop shops of Brooklyn, and we'll take your calls. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Now, if you talk to New Yorkers of a certain age or disposition, they might bemoan the chain storification of the city. Starbucks, Duane Reade, Chase Bank Outposts, once where beloved neighborhood cafe, bar, shop was. But there are still plenty of local businesses in this city of ours, and a new book from the travel publisher Herb Lester Associates is spotlighting 99 beloved small businesses in New York City's most populous borough. The book is called Brooklyn Mom and Pop, A Guide to Neighborhood Eating, Drinking, and Grocery Shopping. It's written by John Hammer and Karen McBurney, and they join me now. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Our listeners, we want to hear from you. We know the valuable roles that a beloved small business can play in a community, and with the holiday season in full swing, here's your chance to plug a favorite establishment of yours. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. If you want to wax poetic about your favorite neighborhood butcher, the local florist, which watering hole, we can drop by, have a couple of cocktails while we're buying presents. 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. Okay, you guys, you've written a lot of different guides. What made you decide to focus on mom and pops in Brooklyn specifically?
That's the stuff we love.
I think also because this is why we're here. This is why a lot of people are here in New York City.
In New York City, yeah.
And
we've lived here a long time, and you have an idea in your head when you move here, and you want it to be New York City.
Right. You don't want it to be a mall.
No.
So what's your definition of mom and pop, just so people understand what we're talking about before we start talking about some of these places?
A business that's owned by the people that are working in it, or, you know, something that's come up in the neighborhood. A lot of these places are anchors for the neighborhood, for the people who
live
there.
Right, they have a real connection with the neighborhood. And a lot of these places are multi-generational affairs, you know.
And the money stays in the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's true,
too. In New York City.
Was there any other criteria for being in the book?
Well, we wanted to focus on things that were at least 30 years old. So there's certain aspects of mom and pop. There's tons of mom and pop businesses in Brooklyn, don't add us, that are not in this guide because they're just too new. And
that did leave out a lot of things that
that we love.
We could do in another book.
exactly. No. And maybe Herb Lester,
maybe
our publisher.
Yeah, maybe they're listening.
A book about the new classics. About that?
Yes.
That might be kind of cool.
That could be. That
absolutely.
Could be. Well, we've done other things for this publisher, Herb Lester, and one of them was a Brooklyn bar guide, and that had no, that was just bars we liked. Could be any year. Could be
like
any year.
Just bars. Like, the other thing I think sort of interesting, and this is where I sort of forget how old I am, like 30 years ago, that was the 50s. That's not the 50s.
No, it ain't the 50s.
Jarring, isn't it?
So the book is also divided in by location, by geography. So the first is North Brooklyn, which constitutes Bushwick, Greenpoint, and Williamsburg. So let me ask you about Teddy's. The first line says, Teddy's claims to be the oldest continually running bar in Brooklyn. What's spectacular about Teddy's?
The stained glass.
Yeah, they have lovely, it's a beautiful bar that goes back, you know, into the 19th century. But I think the important thing about Teddy's, and we used to live just a few blocks away. This was 20 years ago, but we used to live just a few blocks away. And it's always been, like Karen was saying earlier, an anchor for the neighborhood. It's always been a thing that continues.
Strangely enough, there wasn't a lot there at the time.
Right.
And Teddy's
right.
was one of the places that had its doors open and had food.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
In terms of the neighborhood, we all know what's happened to that neighborhood. Why has Teddy survived?
That is a good question, and I don't know. I think they've updated their menu a little bit, and you can't just be old. You have to respond to the changes in the neighborhood, and build on whatever your thing.
Yeah,
was.
The strengths.
Yeah.
So, for example, in Teddy's, what's a way that they have accommodated the new Williamsburg?
They just serve better food than they used to.
Oh, that's really funny. Another location, you talk about downtown, and I can't get my sticky. Where are you? Queen Italian Restaurant, which is at 84 Court Street in Brooklyn Heights. So this says the scenery has changed over the years, but the feel is still 1958. What does a feel of 1958 mean, and what does that look like?
A lot of families, a lot of big tables.
Mm-hmm. And they're really happy to see you.
Yeah.
You make a reservation and they say, oh, thank you. And I can't remember his name now, but so-and-so will see to you tonight.
Yeah, they tell you what you're going to get, that's for sure.
Franco. That's what
Franco.
It says. Franco.
Thank you.
Franco will greet you upon arrival. The menu is fancy Brooklyn Italian restaurant, but the desserts are unusually inviting. Amarena cherries and vanilla gelato doused in espresso or chocolate ravioli or fresh dates cooked in spiced wines and served with mascarpone cheese.
See, again, that's something that's a little bit updated.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure they also have a cannoli.
I mean, we go to a lot of old red sauce Italian places because we love them. But it's nice to get one that, you know, the menu's good.
Let's take a couple of calls. We got Kate, who is calling from Brooklyn Heights. Hi, Kate.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your favorite place?
I've got many in my neighborhood on Atlantic Avenue, but the screener suggested I talk about Heights Chateau, which is owned by a guy called Matthew, who is incredibly kind to everybody who comes in and is determined to always suggest wines and things at prices that people can afford. And when we first moved in, they gave us a free bottle of wine and bought my loyalty for the next 20 years.
So is it that personal service? Is that what really speaks to you, Kate?
Definitely. And also they employ really interesting people who stick around and who have great suggestions.
So yeah, that's always a selling point for us. If you see the same people working there for decades.
We were in Bamonti's last night and
all the same guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
New bartender, though.
Yeah, well.
They'll work him in.
Yeah.
They'll work him in.
He'll be fine.
let's go to Jessica calling from Brooklyn. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Do you have a place you like to shop that's a mom and pop?
I do. It's a family business here in Park Slope called Leopoldi Hardware. It's on Fifth Avenue, and they've been around at least for the 25, 30 years I've lived in the neighborhood. And despite all the gentrification in the neighborhood, there are also lots of fixer-uppers. So it's when you step in there, it feels a little overwhelming because it's a small store, but it's just packed from floor to ceiling with every possible, light bulb, window screen, bird seed, any tool that you happen to need. And even though I don't go there all that often, they've always remembered my name, which shocked me, because it really feels like a small town, family business. And what really endeared me to them was that I was having some trouble getting around. I'd hurt my knee and had gone in there to get a snow melt, in anticipation of the winter weather. And one of the guys said, oh, no problem, I'll just drop it off at your house on my way home. And he dropped off like a 40-pound bag of ice melt, just out of the goodness of his heart, which was just, as sweet as you can be.
What a lovely story. Jessica, thanks for sharing it.
I recommend them anytime. They are the best.
That's where you really need help is a hardware store.
Yeah, you're not going to get that at the Home Depot.
Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We're talking about beloved mom-and-pop shops. Specifically, we're talking about ones in Brooklyn. There's a new guide out called Brooklyn Mom-and-Pop. Our guests are John Hammer and Karen McBurney. They wrote the book. So I'm curious if there's different, in your research about Brooklyn, are there certain neighborhoods where mom-and-pops do a little better than other neighborhoods?
That's a good question. I think all of Brooklyn neighborhoods are changing at different rates, obviously, but they're all changing. New York changes all the time. I don't know. There's certain neighborhoods.
I think they all do well. It's just where they're able to, where the landlord or, whoever will not pull the rug out from under them.
Right. I would say, you know, I was really happy with exploring Bay Ridge, which I hadn't gotten to do a lot of before this book. They're really, you know, they're really strong on the mom and pops and not so many chains.
Has that got a lot to, you mentioned landlords in terms of leases. We all know that there's like the Small Business Survival Act, which Cory Johnson's been behind trying to get people. You just put both hands up in the air. All right, Karen, tell me why you put both hands up in the air.
It's needed. I mean, I think we all know that it's needed. I mean, look at today, we've got our Amazon.
There's a protest
today
in Long Island City about the Amazon head.
Yeah, I mean, we've got so many empty storefronts and urban blight, and
The stockpiling of the storefronts, that's gotta stop. You can't have a city built on density without forcing people to occupy the spaces.
Yeah. Well, part of this act, I mean, businesses could get 10-year leases. They could go to arbitration if they feel that their rent's too high. Do you think both of those would help?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has to.
Let's talk about the West. Melody Lanes. Williamsburg has two bowling-themed bars, but sometimes we want to roll a few frames in a hipster-free environment. Tell me about Melody Lanes at 461 37th Street.
Yeah, that is a hipster-free environment.
Can you describe the place for us?
It's a huge bowling alley, like you would expect it to be out in the suburbs somewhere. Just massive. Yes. And they have this...
It's for recreation.
They have this really sweet bar that's sort of in a glass cube. And behind the bar is a strange character.
Wonderful.
Strangely wonderful character who will talk your ear off about his philosophy of life. Whether you ask him or not, he will talk your ear off.
And he is dressed for the evening as well.
Yeah, he's always looking sharp. Peter Napolitano.
You describe him here, resplendent in starch shirt front and snow white rocker mutton chops.
Yeah, he's quite a guy.
Has he been there since the beginning?
I think that bowling alley is older than he is, but he's been there a long, long time.
So we've got Colette on line 4. She's calling us from Bed-Stuy. Hi, Colette.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, so what's your favorite joint?
One of my favorite joints is Cafe Louverture. It's on Halsey Street, right at Malcolm X. It's the woman that owns it and her husband, she's Haitian American, and it's all Haitian food. And it's all fresh and good and delicious. It's been packed from day one. And they also have some vegetarian selections, which works for me.
Love that. I like having the...
We got to go there.
Yeah. So I'm interested in something, and this is when I know that I feel like I'm a crusty old New Yorker, and I've lived here over more than 30 years, is there's a certain bar I liked, which was a dive bar, which I love to go to all the time, and then Google moved into the neighborhood.
Ugh.
And then it was just full of hoodies. People in the hoodies in the bar, all these tech guys. And I felt like my bar got taken over, but the bar's still a great bar. What advice do you have for people like me? What made me think about it is one of our producers talked about Farrell's Bar and Grills, where firemen go. But it's in Windsor Terrace, which is getting to be a little bit more of a groovy hipster place.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll give them the evil eye there.
Is that what I'm supposed to do, is just stand at the bar and leer at people?
Yeah.
My advice is, this works with any bar, is just go at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's the best time. Then you can pick your crowd.
Also, play something that they hate on the jukebox, if there's a jukebox, which there probably isn't.
Boy, you're mean.
Yeah. I have a funny call. Someone who wants to correct the record. It's Mary on line 2. Hi, Mary. Mary's calling from Long Island. Hi, Mary. You there?
Yeah, I am. Can you hear me?
I can. What do you want to correct the record on?
Oh, I just wanted to say that young lady was discussing a hardware store in her local neighborhood and how the gentleman dropped the ice melt off at her house. And then the young man that you're commentating said you wouldn't find that at Home Depot, and I'd like to say, yes, you would.
All right. Okay, Mary, thank you so much.
I stand corrected.
Well, you know what? There are lots of folks employed by Home Depot. That's the other side of this, right? These big stores.
They do employ a lot of people. That's true.
So aside from this, this is where to eat and drink and all this. Were there any stores people really want to buy from local folks? Is there any stores that you can think of where somebody in Brooklyn might say, hey, I'm going to buy from that local mom and pop?
There's a bunch in the guide.
We have food shops in there.
Yeah. Okay.
And Atlantic Avenue is always, and has been for years,
that's the place
a great
to go.
Source of...
Yeah, everybody knows about Sahadi, but across the street is a thing called Oriental Trading. I would go there for your
Oriental
spices.
Oriental Grocery.
Yeah.
All right. It's a fun guide.
Well written. Thanks.
John Hammer and Karen McBurney, the name of the book is Brooklyn Mom and Pop. Thanks so much for joining us on All of It.
Thanks.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.